The title of the topic, actually the topic for today is officially this is the title I was given, Combating Societal Influences, Being Truly Orthodox in a Society of Plenty. I'm thinking of changing it to Combating Bad Titles in the 21st Century. Anyways, a country couple celebrating their 50th anniversary, and they never argue. And someone asked them, what's their secret? How do they do it? So, he explains that on their first honeymoon, they were a country couple, so they had a horse and buggy, and on their first honeymoon, the horse wasn't moving. So she gets off the wagon, she comes over to the horse, and she gives it a potch, and she goes, that's one. The horse begins to take a couple steps, stops again. She gets back off the wagon, she gives a clop again, she goes, that's two. She comes back to sit down. The horse begins to move a little bit, couple steps, stops. This time she comes out and she shoots the horse. She shoots the horse, unbelievable. She gets back on, the husband's in shock. It's their first anniversary. It's their honeymoon, actually. He never saw. He turns to her and says, why'd you have to shoot the horse? She turns to him and goes, honey, that's one. So, for no other reason than to begin with a joke, I do want to say that we lived for many years in a very closed community. And by virtue of the fact that we were in a closed community, in a sense that there was always this strong social stigma, if anybody broke from the community in any way, the influences that society had to offer were really kept in check. Really kept in check. And as the Enlightenment progressed and moved on, the walls of the insular community began to crumble, and the social stigma, and you're going to shame the family, what are people going to say, what are they going to think, that began to be less compelling for people. And then the onus fell upon us to begin to get creative as to how we are going to preserve our community, how to maintain the integrity of continuity within our religion. In a sense, how to be truly orthodox in a society of plenty. You know, when you think about it, it's really said by the Bubba Vareba Rebbe, the great Hasidic Rebbe. The Bubba Vareba Rebbe said, when he took his first trip to Manhattan, he got to 42nd Street, Times Square, and he asked the driver, who thought they'd probably want to zoom by, the Bubba Vareba Rebbe's not going to want to see. He said, stop the car right here. Stop the car here. The driver for the Bubba Vareba Rebbe is in shock. The Bubba Vareba Rebbe gets out, looks around, comes back in the car. He says, Rebbe, this is where you want to stop? I'm going to take you to Bate Midrash. You want to stop at 42nd Street? He says, yes. Because of people that can live and grow and develop with all of this around them are a people with tremendous merit. He says, it was easy making it when you had absolutely nothing. It's easy becoming a tremendous gaon when there were no pressures around you. But to make it and to have a frum community that's surrounded in our own 42nd streets, whatever they may be, that, he says, I gotta see. And that's really what we face today. We have so much that we're in competition for. The nature of going to shul itself is totally changed. How are we going to keep people's interests? You know, we live in the generation, the ADD generation. I teach 11th grade students, high school. And we spend the first 20 minutes in class cutting up the pills for everyone there is giving out their pills. Who's got you? That's your pill. This is my pill. They're opening up their cases. This is the Monday case. Did I take the Monday or did I take the Tuesday? And they're taking the pills. Everyone's taking pills the whole time. The problem is it doesn't kick in till 4 hours later. So they're off the wall the whole class. And then finally, by the time it's lunch, they're schluffing in the hallway. They're sleeping. So anyways, we have a lot of stimulation in society. It's not easy. And the question is, how are we going to keep ourselves in check? How are we going to remain strong? How are we going to remain a people that, without the luxury of being insular, how could we give to the world, make ourselves available to the world, and still preserve our own? By the way, for those interested in this very topic, I recommend a documentary. It was a story about the Amish community. Story about the wonderful film. I don't remember the name. It was called The Devil's Playground. That's Devil's Playground. A wonderful documentary. And you see their community deals with similar stuff that we're dealing with. The idea of how to allow your own to feel like they have an outlet, but at the same time try to protect and preserve. And of course, they go to a much further extreme than we're used to, but the sampling is the same. The struggle is the same, but our answer is very different. And this past Shabbos, we were able to read about Yaakov at the end of his life. And I thought this would be a perfect place to figure out a couple of nuggets, a couple of tips, how to make it out there on the battlefield of life. Why? Yaakov is there at the end of his life, and he's there with his kids. And what he's doing right now is he's going to be giving each of them blessings. By the way, if you ever read through these blessings, I would not wish half these blessings on my worst neighbor. You know, this is... But anyways, that's how it was back then. He gave them these blessings. They needed to hear what they needed to hear. And in a sense, why it's so crucial to read this section is because they're now in Egypt. They're now in exile. So his last words are going to be choice advice for his children, how to make it out there on your own. How to make it out there. And I think if we pay careful attention to his dialogue with his children, I think from there you find many of the answers and at least approaches that you could take towards combating societal influences. Before looking at it, I do want to note that there are things which I believe to be the wrong focus, and we've given speeches about it, we hear speeches about it in shul, and we're getting up there as rabbis and always hammering at home, but I think we're looking at the wrong place. The four areas that I think are the wrong place to focus on, and I'll explain why. One is money. When we focus on money is the bane of existence, and money is this, and money is the devil, and money is gashmius and physicality, and it's the end, it's going to symbolize the destruction of communities. It's not true. There are plenty of people. There are plenty of people who are able to live a lifestyle whereby they have been fortunate enough to encounter money, raise their children in a very from and cultivating home, themselves been able to grow and live an ethical life. I don't believe it's the amount of money that's circulating now and the amount of consumerism we speak of now, especially around this season. Consumerism, how much people buy, how much they spend. I just saw a figure. People spend on their pets. You know how much they spend on their pets? Over $40 billion in America people spend on their pets. That's a wild amount. That's a wild amount. Unbelievable how much they spend. Why am I telling you this? Because at the end of the day, the person that's spending all this money on their pets, they're not the problem. They're not what's going to cause us. The fact that they bought this contraption that allows the dog to sleep on its back and spend 5 days getting scrubbed in a spa, a beautiful spa on Park Avenue, they're not posing the threat to Judaism. Let them have the spa, let them sit. That's not the problem. It's not the money. Rock and roll, download, iTunes, iPod. That's the bane of existence. It is true that many historians have pointed to the marker of, if you're familiar with the band REO Speedwagon, that since that point and on in history, the topics and themes of rock and roll have just gone totally down the drain. But what we're looking at right now is a total 360. Where bands that are so-called, what we call Christian bands, which don't speak about Christian religion, but speak about good, wholesome ideals, are quickly becoming very popular. Matisyahu. Jewish acts. The Jewish acts in any area of music. Rock and roll, any rock and roll, we could open it up. And if you listen to Matisyahu, you know that half of his stuff is very rock and roll influenced. Beyond that, there are many people who have begun to inculcate the values. For example, music. If you listen to Mordechai Ben David and Avram Fried, if you think that's purely Jewish music, I hate to break it to you. If there was never rock and roll, you would never hear the sounds of Avram Fried and Mordechai Ben David. What I'm trying to say is these things present challenges, but they are not what is crippling and giving us the difficult time that we have. Drugs. This is a problem and a growing problem. But if we can develop the idea, I think it is just the symptom. Or it is what people turn to when the other needs are not being met. It itself is not the problem. It is the drugs and the things that kids turn to. They are the response when the other things that we put in are not being met. And I do really believe that those things we've been focusing on and giving lectures about over and over, they need to be addressed. There are pitfalls in every one of these. Money has its temptations, sex has its temptations, drugs, whatever it is. There are struggles. But they're not the cause. They are not the cause. And I know that because when you read this section of Yaakov talking to his children, he does not warn them, stay away from the money. Stay away from your culture. But Yaakov gives them very different advice and diversified advice. And therefore, I'd like to share with you some lessons from Yaakov that I think we could take with us that might be of help. If you read through the section dealing with Jacob giving these blessings, you'll find that he keeps emphasizing the land, the Eretz. And so that when you come back into the land, this will be your role. And each of the tribes, by the way, are given a different portion in the land. The land, the land, the land. There is a clear emphasis in Judaism on that which is physical. Christianity focuses on the heart. If they would hear this halacha, that one feels the Shabbos, oh, I feel Shabbos, but I didn't keep a single thing, that person has not fulfilled the mitzvah of Shabbos, they'd be in shock. You tell a devout Christian, what do you mean? He kept the spirit of the law. Judaism is a religion that's grounded, tangible. There are physical components to it. It's not enough, just the emotion. The emotion's important, but it's not enough. There are physical components to every mitzvah. There's what we call a maisa mitzvah, the action. There is the aretz, there is the ground. That's why land is so important in Judaism. Wait, land, give up the land and stop. We could save all the lives, give up the land. Forget the land. No, Judaism is a religion that believes in the physical. We do not reject the physical. Land is important to us. God, for whatever reason, wanted us to sanctify this land, to be part of this land, to play a role in it, to develop it, to cultivate it. Land is important. Being grounded is important in Judaism. There is a website which I am afraid of the havoc it may wreak in the next few years. The website is called Second Life. What is it? It's when you first encounter it, it's unbelievable. It is really, mamish, unbelievable. You're living in the times almost of Mashiach. You could feel it when you go to a website like this. What is Second Life? You create a virtual you. It's you the way you wish you would have looked. And you could create every specific thing that you have and tweak it till it's just right. I hate the way my right knee buckles just out. I could fix that. I could change it. I never liked the way my right arm hung down. I could change it. Everything. Whatever I want. Not only that, you could then go to wherever you wish you could be. You ever wish you could lay down in Yankee Stadium and look up at the stars? You could do it. You can go on Second Life and do it. Then I thought to myself, this is tremendous outreach opportunity over here. We got to get someone to create a virtual outreach world. Too late. Chabad's already there. Chabad has set up shop on Second Life as though they've been living there for 400 years. I went, you go there and you can walk into the Lubavitch-based medrash, you could sit down and there's a sheer schedule. You find yourself, you, mini you, on the computer, sitting down, you fold your arms, you could sit any way you want to sit, however you feel comfortable sitting. You could float, which you can't do in a normal sheer. You could float, and you could listen to whatever sheer you want any time of day. It's unreal. You can go to the Kotel. You couldn't get a flight out, it's too expensive. You don't need to go. You can go to Second Life. You can go to the Western Wall. It's unbelievable. What's the problem? It's fantastic. What's the problem? What could be wrong? The problem, it's not real. The problem is it's not grounded. And you create a whole world around you that when you turn off that computer is gone. It's a fantasy. But the difference between a regular fantasy and this fantasy is that it can sweep you up and take you away for days on end. Take you to worlds you've never been to. And before you know it, everyone around you is gone. Your life, passed you by because you were living through this virtual world. This is just the beginning, this second life. It's just the beta, I would say, of what's going to happen. And I begin to already have students who come in dead tired the next morning. Why? They were living that night. They were living in a way they felt they never lived here in this world. They have friends who don't judge them. Virtual friends, because they created them. But it's not grounded. That's not life. Later on down the line, they're going to get married and realize that they have no tools of social interaction. They can't just pick up the gun and say, honey, that's one. And it's scary, and I just use this as an example, not that second life is the bane of existence either, but I use this as an example of that we are getting caught in things that are not real. And we spend so much of our time spending time in things which are not real. I've always been bothered. We're told on one hand, the dangers of wine, for example. You look at the beginning of Bereishis, and you begin to read about Noach, and you find out what happened to Noach after the flood, and Noach profaned himself, and we know that he drank wine, and all the great stuff he did beforehand is almost gone. There are many sources which point to the dangers of wine. The Zohar says that wine and fear of God don't go together. Okay? And then on the other hand, you have sources which indicate that wine is great. The Malbim says the wine is the most beautiful of all the fruits. The grape is the most beautiful of all the fruits. The Kiddush we make every Friday night, that's on wine. That's on wine. So which is it? Is wine a problem or is it a good thing? Which one? It's controversial. The OU has the Kiddush Club policies with the drinking at the Kiddush Clubs. But we'll keep it to simple wine right now before we get to the schnapps and the shlivovitz. So what is it? Is it a good thing or is it a bad thing? I can give you 10... You know, it's also within... You ever... Purim. You spend Purim by Chabad. Or you spend Purim by a bunch of yeshivas. There is drinking like you've never seen. And then you go to YU. And you spend it by the YU Rosh Yeshivas. You can't even find a drip anywhere. You're looking for wine somewhere to make a Kiddush. No one will touch it there. So who's right? Which one is it? Don't touch a single thing. Or go ahead. And I think the answer lies in what Judaism always believes in. And that is the issue of what are you using your escape for? Whatever that escape may be. You ever go on a vacation and when you get back, on the way back, it's the worst feeling in the world? You're packing the bags. You wish you never would have gone on the vacation. Because the feeling of leaving the vacation almost makes it worse than going in the first place. Oh, the cab, getting the taxi, going back from the airport. The whole thing is the luggage. You're waiting for the luggage. When is it a good thing to escape? And I believe the answer in Judaism is that escapism and leaving is healthy. When you're stepping out in order to strengthen yourself to come back. But if you're going to forget the entire world and everything around you, then you have a problem. Noach got off that boat, and Noach stood there. And he's looking around, and he says to himself, oh my gosh, I got to rebuild all this? All my friends are gone? Too much pressure. And Noach turns to the wine so that he can forget his responsibility in this world. That's when the escapism is dangerous. But when you do, as Rav Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin, the great Hasidic master says, when you take that Kiddush cup and you lift it up and you say, I am in control of you. I know how much. I know why I use you and when I use you. There could be moments when it's healthy. There could be moments when that escape is just the right thing for you. When that vacation is just what you needed. Meaning, I would say like this. Why are you going on vacation? Are you going on vacation so you could totally check out and forget about everything in life? Or are you going on vacation so you could come back and be much stronger? If you were leaving for the purpose of coming back, then the journey back home from the trip was the reason you left. And it's a whole different experience. And I think this we need to share with our children and to share with each other, that the escape is valuable in Judaism when it's there to enhance the life we're in right now. Husband and wife that might be having difficulties, sometimes psychologists will recommend that they take a little time apart. Well, it depends. It depends what the time apart is for. It depends what you're going to do with that time. And ultimately, any escape that we take in Judaism has to be with the mindset that I'm only taking it so I could come back stronger. We only check out so that we could check back in. And I think that's one of the lessons that Yaakov was teaching his children by emphasizing the land, the land, the land. Stay grounded. We must be a religion that stays grounded. Our classes cannot be always in the clouds. It needs to be grounded. You know, when we share with our children mitzvahs, when we share with them customs, and you have no clue why you do it, and you have no clue why you're keeping this mitzvah, and the child's wondering, well, why does it apply here and not apply there? And when we have no explanation, the child can't get grounded, and all they see is inconsistency. So we need to keep our religion very grounded, almost in a sense basic, in a way that can be explained. We're very focused on Eretz, on land. There's another component here. Next, Yaakov meets with Ephraim and Menashe. He calls in his grandchildren. He calls in the grandchildren Ephraim and Menashe in the famous episode where instead of putting his hand, right hand on the elder and the left on the younger, he switches it. And Yosef comes in and says, no, father, you've got it wrong. You messed up the hands. I know you can't see too well anymore. You messed up the hands. And Ephraim and Yaakov turns back to Yosef and says, no, I did not. I did not. What I think is happening here is that there are certain expectations. I see it all the times with the teenagers I teach, but we have it in our lives as well. We expect. We are entitled to something. And when we don't get what we thought we deserve, everything falls apart. Everything falls apart. It comes down to a sense of entitlement. There's a wonderful book that just came out. It's called The Teen Whisperer. It's about a guy on a ranch in Missouri. And what he does is he works with teenagers. And he's an expert in talking to teens. And he's found that the most difficult thing to break through is that children nowadays have a sense of, I am entitled to this. This is what I deserve. And the problem with it is not a problem of that it's going to be they're going to be spoiled or this or that. That's not the problem. The problem is what happens later in their lives when that which they felt that they were entitled to does not come through. And that's when you're faced with depression. When you expect that your shul was supposed to be the most spiritual place in the world, that I was supposed to take a class, take a course in Judaism, and I was supposed to be moved. When I had a rabbi who was supposed to be perfect. Well, one goes in with a certain expectation and a certain entitlement that sets themselves up for failure. And Yaakov was teaching Yosef that there is nothing that is expected in our religion. It's not what you think. I have other intentions over here and reasons for doing what I am doing. Many have spoken about, and I think related to this, is the power of gratitude. When one feels they're entitled to everything, they take away the one faculty that can make them a healthy human being, and that is gratitude, being thankful. Rav Soloveitchik has such a beautiful idea. Rav Soloveitchik says that in the Nishmat prayer, which we say in Davening on Shabbos morning, so there's a debate in the Talmud as to whether the words that should be inserted should be Rov HaTishpachot or Kol HaTishpachot, that we give God the majority of praise or we give God all of the praise. What kind of debate is this? Give God the whole thing. Give it all up to God. What do you mean give only a majority of the praise? Why would anybody think it should be Rov HaTishpachot? So Rav Soloveitchik said, beautiful idea. He said, God says, you know what? If everybody's always just thanking me, then they can always say about anything good that happens in their lives, they will never appreciate anybody else. Well, hey, that person was only there because God created them in a certain way that they would come at that time and give them that opportunity. And nothing in our lives could ever be something you could feel gratitude towards another about. It's all God. No one did anything for me. No one does a single thing. And Rav Soloveitchik says that God wants us to feel that feeling of gratitude towards other people. So God says, I'll take a little less. Keep 25% for yourself. This way you share it with each other. And it's very important. You see people in a restaurant. This is when you really see it. You see people in a restaurant when the waiter makes a mistake. You watch how a person treats that individual and they treat them as though, how could you have done that? I ordered my meal 20 minutes ago. I expect to have my food. I'm not tipping a single thing here. Besides even realizing it wasn't his fault in the first place, probably the chef mixed something up. But the idea is we work ourselves up till we're crazy. We get so worked up because we expected. We had so many expectations. This has to be like this. This must be like that. And what happens when it doesn't? We make ourselves meshuggah. Does this mean we shouldn't expect anything in life? Certain things to go a certain way? Of course there's a baseline expectation. You expect, hopefully you're going to wake up the next morning. If you don't, you can't be upset anyways. So that works itself out. But you have a few basic expectations in life. But beyond that, the Torah teaches us everything is a gift. Every single thing is a gift. The problem is we just take it for granted. All of life is a gift and we take it for granted. And I think that is a powerful factor that we should be teaching each other and teaching our children. Gratitude for what you have. You know, I don't think we realize there's actually a non-Jewish Muslim teacher who teaches in the high school that I teach at, MTA. And the Muslim teacher, she turned to me and she said, "These Jewish students, they have no clue what they have. They have no clue." She tried to check her son who was ill, into Sloan Kettering. Sloan Kettering is the hospital that treats mainly cancer patients. And she went to Sloan Kettering, and she said she got there. And she was alone, just her and the doctor. She saw a Jewish kid two doors down. There's Chai Lifeline walking in. There's the Beker Cholim organization walking in, Satmar walking in, all day and all night, Jewish organizations are walking in, and she's sitting alone. And she said, "I teach these students, and they have no clue what they have in their lives. They have no clue what kind of family we have, what kind of support group." And you know what? Then when there's too much homework, or something doesn't go right, when they get slighted in shul, when we get slighted in shul, someone took our seat in shul. I can't take this. Because it's expectations. We don't realize there's a lack of gratitude for what we have. And when we have gratitude towards what we have in this community, we could feel so proud. And that pride, as I heard in the end of the last session, when we instill pride in our children, it's a totally different story. Next. One of the famous lines in this section is the blessings that are given to Yisachar and Zevulun. Jacob gives the blessings to his children, Yisachar and Zevulun. One of you will learn the Torah. One of you will provide the money. One of you will learn. One of you will support the other one. And those will be your roles. Yisachar and Zevulun. Rav Kook has such a powerful line. Rav Kook, the first chief rabbi of Israel, says that people leave the path of Judaism because they were forced into a style of learning Torah that did not speak to them. What that means is as follows. Each of us has a unique soul. We each have a unique experience in the way we encounter Hashem. If we spend our lives surrounded by teachers, surrounded by a style of Judaism that didn't speak specifically to us, you are setting yourself and your children up for failure. The first Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, says, you know why there were so many tribes? Why couldn't there be one tribe? Save all the fighting. One tribe. He says, the reason is because God was teaching us that within the framework of Torah Judaism, there can be so many different colors. There can be so many different options. And the trick is to find that which is unique to you. If you're someone who mystical study is not for you, you shouldn't be spending your time day after day stuck in a course that focuses on mysticism. If you're someone who is a person who loves politics, loves to hear interaction of politics and Judaism, you should be finding a niche, be finding a shul, finding a place where that speaks to you. And that's very important. Jacob turns to Yisachar and Zevulun and says, you have unique jobs. You have unique roles here. And you cannot mix the two. You need to find your unique identity and use that. And the problem is when you have people who are in the wrong place, in the wrong community, And we all need to find where our zone is, where our specific area is of inspiration, where our specific area where we could be uplifted, where we specifically can make a difference. That's what Yaakov was teaching Yisachar Zvulun. You know, there's a concept called life readiness. I touched on it for a minute Friday night at the panel. And a lot of the psychologists are talking about it today, that our schools, our high schools particularly, are not focusing on preparing children for life. They're teaching them information, which will get them to the next level where they need more information, but we have not given our children the tools they need to fend through life. What are they going to do when they get laid off of the job? Do they have any knowledge or information of resource, what recourse, what they're going to do? Have you begun to plant the information in their head of what their interests might be so they're not stuck 10 credits into college realizing, oh my gosh, now I have to choose. I have to make a decision for the next 10 years of my life. If you start a little early, beginning to prepare our children for life and decisions that are going to emotionally prepare them for life, then our schools can change entirely. And I think that is essential as well. We do not know our roles in the community. This is true on a level way beyond high school, way beyond college. We do not know where we could play a role. People come up to me in the shul all the time, and they ask me, how can I help? The answer is not just to keep them busy, but the answer is to find a way to give them their unique skill and make use of it. We all have some unique contribution, and it's important that we tap into it. And if we're going to preserve our people, we need to turn to our children and find their unique qualities and work on that. If we're sending all our children to the same school just because, even though we know for one kid it's the wrong fit. You know, there's a Rosh Yeshiva in YU who has 8 kids going to 6 different schools. Why? He's not one of those problem parents who gets in a fight at every school. Rather, his thing is he realizes with his wife that each of our children are unique. He sent one of his children to a left-wing school, one of his children to a right-wing school, one of his children to a more spiritually oriented school. And that's the answer, is figuring out what we each uniquely need. That's very important, because we put the wrong people in the wrong place, we set ourselves up for failure. It works the opposite way as well, by the way. When we put people in positions of leadership over our community, when it was the wrong fit. It was the wrong fit. You had someone who came in with a mentality that was perfect in another community, and you bring them in and you put them and expect magic to happen, but you should have known, you should think about it beforehand. Is this the right fit? Forget all the glamour, forget all the success. Is this right now the right fit? That's what you have to ask yourself. That is the lesson of Yisachar and Zvulun. Figuring out all of our specific needs. And in your own life, you need to figure out what it is that you need out of life. Yaakov then turns to his children. And in one of my favorite lines in the entire Torah, he says, Heyasfu v'agidu lachem. Heyasfu v'agidu lachem. He turns to them and says, come together. And I will now tell you. Hey, asvu va'agidu lachem. Why is that unique? The holy Rishna Rebbe. Who is the Rishna Rebbe? For those that don't know Chassidus. The founder of Chassidus was the Baal Shem Tov. His primary student was the Mezritcher Magid, who was a master teacher. The Mezritcher Magid had under him 8 of the famous, most famous Rebbes ever. He had the founder of Lubavitch. He had the first Belzer Rebbe. The great grandson of the Mezritcher Magid was Rav Yisrael of Rizhin. He was famous for always being dressed in royal garb. He came out with the trumpets. There used to always be fanfare. That was his style of Chassidus. Very unique style of Chassidus. The royalty. The style of royalty. If those who've seen pictures of the Rizhiner Beit Medrash before the war, you know what a regal building looked like. Very regal. That was the style of Rizhin. It stood in contrast to the ways of Kotsk, which were very simple, bare minimum. So the Rishon Rebbe says, Heyasfu v'agidu lachem means as follows, that my message can only be imparted successfully if heyasfu, if you stand together. If you don't stand together, my message is going to get muddled. This is so crucial. The social support that we give each other is so important that we are there for each other. You know, all these things we're focusing on, I think there's a common denominator here. If you focus on the ethics and the person and the individual and how we relate to each other, I think the things that are the traps will fall by the wayside. You know, the individuals I know that turn to drugs, the students I know that battle with these things day in, day out, very seldom are the ones that were feeling validated by their peers, by their friends. It's usually the one that's the outcast. They call it the new trend now is the goth. Goth is you wear all black and you have the black fingernails, very dark. Why? You isolate yourself. And the idea there is that when we are alone, it's a scary world. And Yaakov is saying, hey, asfu v'hagidu lachem. There's a reason I ask that there be a minyan three times a day. I don't ask you just to pray. I ask you to make minyanim. You need support groups. There's a reason. There's an emphasis on Judaism in the shul. Coming to the shul. Because there's an idea of, hey, asfu, coming together. We cannot go at this alone. And the more we try to do it on our own, without those around us, it becomes a very scary place. Hey, asfu va'agidu lachem. There's a book, I don't know if any of you have read it, it's called Off the Derech. Came out a couple years ago. Anybody here have read the book Off the Derech? We have one or two, three, four. All right, Off the Derech. I'll give you the whole summary. Yeah, you're going to get the whole book right now in a minute. I'm not minimizing the book. I'm just telling you it could be summarized in one powerful line. In this book, Farhanuk Margolis, who's actually a Los Angeles native, traces the roots of why people go off the derech, why they leave the path of Judaism. And there's around 20 different explanations. Each one is unique, and we shouldn't pigeonhole anybody into one explanation. You never know. They had a Rebbe who just abused them verbally. They could have had a terrible experience in the home. They could have been, drugs could have swept them up in a drug culture. 20 different explanations. At the end of the day, there is one definition, which is the common denominator between all 20. And it runs as follows. Observance equals positive feelings plus belief plus ability to implement. I'll say it again. Observance equals positive feelings plus belief plus ability to implement. What I mean is like this. Before our schools woke up and implemented special education curriculum in Jewish high schools and Jewish day schools, those that had learning disabilities were incapable of going through the Chumash, of learning a Gemara, taking part in an average shir, because they had no entry point. And what happens? Frustration. They're no longer feeling validated by their Judaism. They're cut off from their community because those outlets that are working for all their friends and inspiring them does not work for them. That's one example. Positive feelings. If every time they remember Judaism was always over a fight, their parents always fighting at the Pesach Seder, their parents always fighting. I have a student who dreads going home for Shabbos. He is so afraid to go home for Shabbos because that's the only time his mother and father are home together. And he knows the fireworks are going to fly. So now, Nebuch, this kid has in his head, for the next 20 years, automatically, it's right away, whenever the word Shabbos will come up in his head, he will see his parents fighting, and the two will always go hand in hand. And it will be very difficult to undo all of that. Observance equals positive feelings, plus belief, plus ability to implement. If we are not feeling validated by our Judaism, we leave it. We're going to leave it behind if we feel that those around us are not good and decent people. If we feel isolated and cut off, we're going to leave it behind. And it's a very significant idea, because it's this idea of Heyasfu v'agidu lachem. Figure out a way to come together here. Figure out a way to connect, because if we don't connect, we are going to be trapped. Figure out a way to bring in those on the periphery. We have to make our shuls more accessible to those that don't understand what they're saying. Those that don't feel comfortable when they walk into shul. Do we have yarmulkes ready for them? Do we have someone handing them a sitter? welcoming them? Do we have someone that might sit next to them? It doesn't have to be someone who works for the shul. It could be any of us who's sitting next to that person in shul. Move over. Sit with them, saying, right now we're page 42. You show them over. You show them. You help them out. Is there people helping with entry points? Helping bringing people in. Hey, asfu va'agidu lachem. The message of Judaism will only resound and only relate clearly if we are being hey asfu, if we are coming together, if we are insulating ourselves, cutting off anybody who is not the norm. Not society's influence that is the problem. It's when we don't have these basic elements that Yaakov was teaching us in place, that's when society becomes the major problem. I think if you could summarize what we're saying here today, it's that. Society definitely has influences. There's no doubt about it. There, we are being pulled in all different directions. But the main idea is that Judaism is a beautiful system. Yaakov was giving a beautiful system to his children and teaching them. Society will only be a trap for you. These drugs, the rock and roll, all of it. It's only going to be a snare and a trap. If you can't figure out these basic components, if you can't figure out how to hayasu v'agidu lachem, bring yourselves together, if you can't figure out the lesson of Ephraim and Menashe, of gratitude, being thankful for what you have in your life, not expecting everything, and when it doesn't come, I'm depressed. How to figure out these basic social elements in relating to each other, that's the strongest way, Yaakov says, we're going to combat. Because otherwise, what's Yaakov doing? He knows they're right now going to be stuck in Egypt. After he got back with Yosef, his prophecy came back. He knows what's coming. Why is he telling them these lessons? You're going to make money, you're going to learn. Talk to them. Listen, I want you to keep separate dishes. Go through all of that. He didn't do that then because he realized all the separations, while extremely important, they're the secondary component to the idea of making sure the social structure is intact. If you could do that, everything else in Judaism will enhance, make your life easier, and make your life better. But you gotta have this in place. And that's what Yaakov's trying to share with his children. Levi. He turns to Levi. And you know, Shimon and Levi, those who know about these brothers, so he tells him off. Once again, this is supposed to be the beautiful brachas, the end of his life. This is a way to go. What were the last words from your father? You're a low life. Right? This is the way to go. But he turns to Shimon and Levi and he says to them, you guys are violent. You have no control. What did they do? Remember what Levi did? Shimon and Levi destroyed, decimated an entire town. Shechem. They decimated an entire city when they took their daughter Dina. When their sister Dina was taken and violated. So Shimon and Levi took retribution and wiped out the entire city there. The whole trick, they had everybody get a bris, they're tired, they're weak, they're defeated. That's when they came in, the day after the bris, everyone was there, they slaughtered the entire city. So he tells them, Yaakov tells his kids, you guys are too much. Too much. So I have a question. Who are the ones that became the teachers of Torah? Who are the ones that became those that stayed separate and studied the Torah, that cultivated the religious experience in Judaism? Which tribe was that? Levi. Yaakov put our kids in the care and in the hands of the violent one. Meaning, you understand this? Yaakov gave the one to teach our children, to teach us, to teach everyone the Torah, the guy who's got the most violence running through his blood. This is not my question. This is the question of the great Rosh Yeshiva of Yaakov Kamenetsky. In his Emes LeYaakov, he says, why did Yaakov pick Levi of all the people? He says, well, Yaakov had a problem with the temper. Well, Yaakov had a problem with their anger. What he realized was that what we need is passion. We need people who are going to stand up when the Jewish people are humiliated. We need people who are going to stand up for what they believe in. Not be wishy-washy about it. Stand up and say, enough is enough. He goes, those are the people that are going to inspire our people. You can't have a lackadaisical teacher up there, open the Chumash today, page 23. We read the Pasuk we read yesterday. Right, the teachers we used to have. I had one Rebbe used to take a nap in the middle of Shir. He mamish took a nap. He put his head down and shluft. He's out. He's out cold. You guys, set up chavrusas. A couple minutes. He went to sleep. He put himself out. No one's going to get anything from that. You have someone who's passionate. Even if you disagree with their message, you still walk away with something. You know what? You ever have that? You could be in a class, you could be in a shiur, and the guy is so dispassionate, and the woman is so dispassionate about what he or she is teaching. Even if it's beautiful nuggets, you walk away with, you'll forget it in a week. You could have someone the opposite. Almost no content, so passionate. It'll affect you. You'll say a little shallow for my needs, a little infantile, but you won't forget it. So Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky says, while these people are a little bit dangerous, they'll work it out. They'll spend time working out, they'll go to anger management, whatever it is, but at the end of the day, they're still going to have their passion. That's who we want teaching our children, the passionate ones. This is so, again, it is about the passion. You ever speak to someone, talk to someone who's a devout Christian. They are so in love with their beliefs. You know, I get they have these things, they don't have them here. In New York, they have what's called gypsy cabs. What's a gypsy cab? A gypsy cab is it's a non-official taxi. It's usually a car service of some type, and you can hail them up by YU, so you can hail them up by Washington Heights. So you get a gypsy cab. I can't go two or three cabs without the driver engaging me in a theological discussion. Why? Not because he wants to debate, they're never combative, but rather because they want to talk about how much they love their religion. They're done with the questions. They say, don't you? And they want to just hear a whole discussion of love. And one guy, I'm in a car, and he's going on for 25 minutes how him and his pastor spent the day all day yesterday crying and weeping and praying and crying, and we were weeping and crying and praying. And I'm thinking to myself, I got to get out of this car. I got to get out of here. All the weeping and praying. And he loved it. He loved it. But you know what? We don't have that. We don't have that. We are missing that, and it could be we are very cynical people. We love cracking jokes. And we sometimes take the air out of serious situations. When there's something serious and a really moving moment, we find a way to knock it down. It's the Jewish way. It could be because we've needed it to combat with all the difficulties we faced in our history, that we found this cynical side, this humorous side to us that can make light of any situation. We invented gallows humor. There's no doubt about that. But because of that, we've lost the ability for passion. You know, if you look, I've begun now preparing, I'm putting together a little work on the Megillah, Megillat Esther, and I've begun looking at this party that Ahasuerus had. And Ahasuerus has this whole party he throws for the people of Shushan, and the Jews get in such trouble for going to this party. I mean, you get the reputation they get is because they took a part in this party of the Russia of Ahasuerus, and I'm looking through the words, what'd they do wrong? You know, it was a party that was a little bit excessive, but if you look at the verses, there's nothing there that really runs antithetical to Judaism. It seems like it was a pretty clean party until he called Vashti out. There was nothing really, and she didn't even come out, so there was nothing really wrong in the end. No harm, no foul at this party. So I saw one commentary who said that the party was that when you could stay at a party that long, day and night, and never go home, it means you're not bored. And if you're not bored, it means you are really into this. It means you have all this passion for what's going on. You're loving it. And the problem was, it wasn't so much what was going on at the party. It's that the Jews were able to spend day and night having such passion and such love. And God's wondering, do they ever have this passion for Shul? You ever see a Jew say, I don't want to stay. Don't end the davening. Don't end. Keep going. Keep this going. You'll never have it. You'll never see this. You'll never see. I guarantee you. Every Jew's looking. When's the kiddush? When's the kiddush? He just left 2 minutes to the kiddush club. When's the kiddush? He ran out of herring early. I told him to get the matches. He got the schmaltz. Every time I tell him to get with the gribbinets. And we can't wait to get out. Before we get in, I'll take a breakfast. I'll have a whole breakfast, a Danish. I'll get there. The shul's always going to be there. The shul's not going anywhere. That's the Jewish way. The shul's a nice place for Jews to hang out together. Right? Jackie Mason always says, right? An opera is a place for rich Jews to go to sleep. That's what it is. The shul's become a place for Jews to sit together, schmooze. That's what it is. It's unfortunate. It's unfortunate. The sample of the guy weeping with his pastor, I don't know if that'll ever happen for us. But the idea is, where is our passion? Remember 1991, January 27th, it was the Super Bowl. I know we're holding by the zmanim now of the football coming to an end for this season. And it was Tampa Bay, Florida, Super Bowl 25. And Buffalo is favored by a long shot to beat the New York Giants. And with only moments left, they're trailing the Giants by one. And the kicker, Scott Norwood, has the chance to take the lead with a 47-yard field goal. Suddenly, he's about to kick, and the Giants call a timeout. They call timeout. Why? Brilliant strategy. It was called icing the kicker. He's got all this adrenaline. He's ready to go out there and kick this ball. He can't wait. He's going for it. He's got this. He's passionate about what he's doing. Freeze him. Call a timeout. He's got to now sit. The nerves can kick in. He's biting his nails. And Scott Norwood gets up after that 2-minute timeout and blows it. Field goal, way to the right. He misses it and they lose. They took the passion away. And I think if you look at what the problem we have with Amalek, the problem we always have with Amalek and the Jewish people, what'd they do? Asher kar chabaderech, kar from cool. They cooled us down. Anybody tries to take away our passion, that is such a crippling effect for the Jewish people. We come to our close. There is so much to say. And Yaakov was aware that there were going to be problems. Yaakov knew what was coming up. And he has these blessings he gives these his children to try to head it off at the pass. And if you look closely to these blessings, you'll realize these blessings are not blessings about how religious you have to be, how committed, how many times you have to daven. They're social issues. Because the social issue is the issue that's going to help you survive as a people and allow you to keep the essential rest of the Torah. It's going to allow you to combat society's influences. Society's not the problem. We gotta figure it out. The onus is on us. Finish with a Dvar Torah from the Lubavitcher Rebbe of Menachem Mendel Schneerson. Such a nice idea. This week's Parsha is Parsha Shmos coming up. Shmos keeps talking about Elish Shmos B'nai Yisrael. These are the names of the Jewish people who came into Mitzrayim. What's with all the names? I already want to show how much God loves His people. The names, the names, the names. What's with the names? So the Lubavitcher Rebbe says, because it was coming to teach you, that it was only the names that went into exile. It was only the external that was lost. The internal, our identity, who we are as a people, what we stand for, our values, our ethics, our commitments, that never left town. That was always there in place, and that's what allows us to survive. God willing, we should be able to fortify ourselves in the sense of our ethics and how we are to other people in a social level, take the lessons of Yaakov Avinu, and in that way, we won't have to combat society. The problems that society faces vis-a-vis us will fall away on their own. Have a great day. What do you mean the four areas of focus?
Money.
Oh, yeah, money,
drugs.
Money, drugs, sex, rock and roll.
Then people turn to
what's going on with their focus. Money. Money. Drugs. The music thing is money, and it's rock and roll. Money, drugs. Yeah. I should have heard that. There you go. Next session on sex.